Thank you, David and Lois, for helping us in our musical worship. We will now be helped in the word worship with David coming and opening God's word to us for the next three Sundays. David Johnson has been I've known David Johnson longer than I've known Barb. He was just a young squirt in college when I met him, and even at that time, he had a hunger and a thirst to talk about the Lord and his word. And it's only gotten worse since then. He has a passion for God's word, a passion for God's work, a passion for God's glory, a passion for his people. He's joined today. Brenda is back there rooting him on. And if it's anything like what I have, there'll be some sign language going on telling you where to change things up as you're going. No. I've appreciated David. He is a graduate of Dallas Seminary, as I am, and he has been just a longtime servant in many capacities in God's word and in God's ministry, educationally and in other ways as well. I know you will have already expressed great appreciation for the times he has been with us. I appreciate him helping me again to be able to be free to minister overseas but most importantly, I appreciate his hunger is that we will know God better through opening the word. And so with eagerness, we look forward to how David's going to be used of the Lord even now. David, come give us the word.
There's always the danger of staying around someone too long, they'll know too much about you. Drake knows too much about me, so that's for certain. There are a couple of things I want to note before I get started. The challenge of time is always my challenge, to not use more of it than I should. And then I see the elements of the Lord's Supper in front of me, and now I realize there's a hard stop so we can do this. I was expecting it would go the other way around, that I could linger at the end. No, I'm going to have to do a hard stop. My wife and I love to share communion with the saints, and we're so glad to be here this Sunday. There's another element that I want to talk about with regard. This is a preamble. I haven't started yet, so give me some time here. Drake has mentioned, and he's wearing the lapel pin of the U.S. and Israel flags. There's a moment when all that stuff out there is actually within your disposal right here. You can do something now that you could never have done before in regard to international intrigue, politics, tragedy, and redemption. And the reason I point this out, I was contacted a couple of months ago through an offhanded luncheon with some men I'd just gotten to know recently, and I was introduced to a project that's occurring right now in this city, well, not Terrell, but in this area, Dallas, in conjunction with the Israeli government. It reaches all the way into Benjamin Netanyahu's office. When he had surgery for a hernia just a few weeks ago, there is an American citizen who also is an Israeli citizen. His name is Ron Dermer. And Ron is actually within the office of Netanyahu, and he's trying to make sure that the right resources are being administered as the soldiers are coming back from the battle. Imagine, if you will, that you're in the battle of your life, dealing with what we've seen now, as Drake mentioned, 6 months. We had a team go over recently to Jerusalem and met with Netanyahu's office and got the support for the project that we were doing to raise money to provide counseling from a Christian perspective for Jewish soldiers coming back from Gaza. The trauma that these soldiers are experiencing, please remember, they're conscripted in their late teens, 18, 19, and 20, to serve in the army from the very outset of their adult life. What is assumed to be their obligation to serve and protect their country actually produces almost an unaddressed circumstance of trauma in the life of these young men and women. They do this enormous task of protecting their world, as we saw happen in October. And then they come home after having served, because they're reserved, they're pulled into battle, they go back, and this back and forth experience. And then they're coming from all over the world. Israeli soldiers are coming from all over the world to go home and defend the citizens of the country. That trauma needs to be addressed. The Israeli army is attempting to do that, but it needs greater resources. And I'm involved in a project with people who are trying to bring resources together with Christian counselors to provide trauma counseling and circumstance and seminars that would help them. And we're raising money. We've met with the Prime Minister's office. We have met with the senior rabbi in Israel. And we have met with military leaders. Now, I was not there, but our team was. And we've come back now trying to kick off a campaign to raise money, and people like us can touch a difference maker in the life of the Israeli soldiers. I don't want to say any further about it because we can talk about that sort of thing afterward, but I just want you to know there are moments in which where you are can make a difference in the world around you. And in regard to the political thing that's now hit our land, and you see it on the college campuses, it feels very much like the 60s. Drake said he was a child. Don't forget, Drake's from Berkeley. And if you need to know anything about Berkeley, it is the liberal bastion of the West, like the University of Texas is in Texas, or any other number of places that I could make fun of some of you alumni, but I'll stop there. I'm from SMU, so I have my own issues. But the circumstance is, I remember the 60s being very uncomfortable, and everything made me nervous. I was a second and third grader. Can you imagine the children seeing all the stuff that is happening today and how unnerving that can be about our safety? We grew up in the atomic age. What meant was Russia's going to get us anytime or the Soviets could get us anytime. So we had these moments of the 60s where we had the Bay of Pigs and we had the civil unrest in our own country. And 68 was a crack in time. We had enormous things. We had the Tet Offensive that showed that they could get into Saigon and we were no longer winning a war, or there was the death of Martin Luther King Jr., there was the death of Bobby Kennedy, and that happened in April and July of that year. Then we had the Democratic, wait till the summer when we have the primaries finished, and we have the conventions with the Democratic Convention and the Republican Convention. Watch what happens this summer. It will remind some of us as 68, with the Chicago 7 in Chicago, later the Republican Convention in 68 was in Miami, Florida. And my family moved to Miami that summer. I was nervous all the time because there felt like such angst in the world. We didn't use that word. I had to go to school to buy that word, angst. But we know what it feels like. I just am uncomfortable. And I wonder, what's the future look like? So there is that kind of swirling uncertainty around us. And then we look up, and if we've lived long enough, like some of us have, we recognize that this is kind of the way the world is. And there will always be those moments. I had the blessing of living with my grandparents when I was a new believer. I was in college. And I had this enthusiasm for the way I wanted to do things. And my grandparents always felt like they were kind of putting a bit in my mouth and kind of pulling on the reins to pull me back and calm me down because I had enthusiasm for what I wanted to do. I was one of those young guys in the story of Jesus talking about the woman who had been caught in adultery. If you remember, all the men picked up rocks. Remember that story in John chapter 8? If you'll remember, when Jesus bent down to write in the dirt, half the group dropped their rocks. The other half held on to their rocks. Well, it's interesting to note that John was noting that the group that dropped their rocks were which age group? The old guys dropped their rocks first. The young guys held on to their rocks. They weren't ready to give up yet. I've always wondered if it was because the list of sins in the old guys was long enough, they knew, okay, I'm going to lose this fight. Here's my rock. Or maybe it was just the pride of the youth that you were going to succeed with the other guys that quit. And you hold on to your rocks. And at some point, we reach a stage where we go, maybe it's time to lay things down and just accept the world as we see it. And that leads maybe sometimes to a malaise or a sense around which it just doesn't matter. We don't make a difference in the world. It's going to happen anyway, so why worry about it? Somehow I still argue against traffic. I still feel I'm going to make progress in traffic. I'm going to somehow get ahead of that guy that's holding us all up. If you come down 205, one guy is all it takes, and we are all conformed to his image. That's it. It's one guy. And it's like that. You go to Dallas and you go onto the freeways. Y'all know the system. For all of you who commute, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You just kind of at some point, just calm down, just relax, drink your coffee, listen to your podcast, and don't worry about the traffic, right? How many of you do that? Anybody? Okay, a few of y'all do that. All right. I think that one of the greatest moments of the turning of the age, and we never will leave this. In the words of my good friend Bob, he said one day, you should never go back to the fundamentals because you should have never left the fundamentals. And we leave the fundamentals and we think we've made progress, so let's move on. But what we have to know is there are certain things, this turning of the age, not the turning of the page, but the turning of the age, occurred in the line between chapter 2 and chapter 3 in the book of Genesis. Don't turn there because we're not going to be there. But I want that to be the frame of reference for us. Because in chapter 2, the creation account under those circumstances closes, and the husband and wife are together, they are unashamed, and they are unclothed, and they didn't know it. The world from which there had been some chaos has been ordered and structured, and what man needed, man had. Okay? What man needed, man had. His loneliness was completed with a partner. They had the food. They had a job. They had a roof over their heads. That's all that we need, right? And then one thing showed up in the next chapter 3. And the most crafty of all the beasts, all the animals and the beasts of the fields showed up with a question for Eve. And she didn't handle the question right. And all of a sudden, what was prohibited was tempting. And we have the fall. And in the fall, all of chapter 1 and 2 is reversed. Not totally eradicated, but ruined. And the things that existed with intention now is going to have to be done with frustration. So the man is going to work just like he was intended to do, but that work will come from the sweat of his brow. And with the thistles and the thorns of the pasture that he was going to not have to deal with. So work is now frustrating. The woman who was going to bear children will now do so with pain. There will be labor-intensive pain, not just the moment of birth, but in the rearing of the children, life will be difficult. But you'll still have your children. So all of God's intention is unabated, it's just now frustrated. So the world has become futile. And in some cases, it's also meaningless. Because we do things all the time for which there's no progress. We do it year after year, and it looks like we make progress, and all of a sudden, we're back to where we started. You ever had that feeling? I was playing in a golf tournament on Tuesday. It was a golf tournament fundraiser. I was a guest of one of the administrators of a Christian school in the area, and they chose to have the golf tournament at a place over in Grapevine, right below the dam of Grapevine Lake. And they had these little tees, golf tees. Y'all can't see it, but at the top it says Cowboys Golf Club, and there's a star at the top. And around the circumference of the golf tee, you don't need to worry about counting, I've done it for you. There are 5 rings around the golf tee. So I was asking some of the guys I was playing with, hey, you know why there's 5 rings around this tee? And they said, no. How many Super Bowls have the Cowboys won? 5. These rings symbolize the 5 Super Bowl champions, 71, 77, 92, 93, 95. In case you're wondering, I do remember those days. Do you know how many orders they've put in for a golf tee with 6 rings around it? None. Because year after year, the Dallas Cowboys disappoint. And we still get excited thinking, now it's our turn. How many of you watched the draft a week ago? Y'all are happy people. There's not anybody to raise their hand. That's the first time I've ever asked a question. Nobody I used to work the draft every single year in the office of the Dallas Cowboys, right next to Jerry Jones, his administrative assistant. When the draft came up, we would print out the name and put it on the wall, pre-computer, by the way. And we would hand post all the draft picks, and all the scouts would come out. We would listen to the conversation, which was right in front of us. Now it's a big, huge show. Hollywood took over. It's not the same anymore. But here's the point of a silly football thing. How frustrating it is to be a fan of your team. How about a Cleveland Brown fan? I can complain about the five and how long it's been 30 years since we won our last. But I remember a lot of other teams that are frustrated. You put your heart out there and you're disappointed again. All that kind of stuff. How about the world of right in front of us? You know what's about to hit us this spring? We've already had the eclipse 2 weeks ago. That's a crazy thing. We're about to have Cicada Garmin or something like that. Have you ever heard of a trillion insects crawling out of the ground in the next 2 months? Does that sound scary? It happened a few years ago, but not at this scale. My son was 4 or 5. And one night we're at a friend's house. It's a party. It's a picnic. And my son came over with a muddy bug. Couldn't tell what it was. I looked at it closely. We got it home. We washed off the mud. Come to find out, after probably 17 years in the dirt, this bug dug his way out to be found by my 4-year-old son. He surely was a happy bug, because my son loved bugs. We took that bug home, and for about a week, we're trying to do the math today, just trying to figure out how long it takes. We concluded maybe a week, and this muddy bug grows up. All of a sudden, it's time for him to split out of the back of his cocoon. Remember how you used to as a kid? We were here last year, and this building was covered in cicada skins. It was like this. I love that. I love the sound of them. I love the whole. I grew up calling them locusts, but they're cicadas, according to what I've heard. 17 years in the ground, and he lands in the hands of a 4-year-old little boy who loves bugs. Every single day, the lesson was, what's going on with the cicada? We watched it, and one day he split and came out of his shell. Now he's got a wet body. He's got wet wings. He needs to dry off. Took about a day. And finally, I said to my son, Ryan, I said, Ryan, he's got a job to do after 17 years. You need to let him go. He's only got a few months to live. It was a painful thing because he had raised the cicada. And he had fixed his affections on this cicada. So I remember walking out of that house in Richardson, and he walks out with that cicada in his hand. And he opened that hand, and that cicada goes, bzzz. He didn't make it halfway across the street until a mockingbird swung by and snapped that cicada up right out of the air. 17 years I've been waiting for this moment in my first flight. I'm taken out by a mockingbird. And I'm thinking, from the cicada's point of view, that 4-year-old was a failure. From a mockingbird's point of view, I love that 4-year-old. But from life's point of view, are you serious? I just spent all this time to get taken out the first time I fly. So I stood there and watched the most amazing thing I've ever seen in the life of a 4-year-old. My son immediately burst into tears, because you could hear as the mockingbird clamped his beak down, that cicada was screaming off into space. And my son burst into tears, and I started seeing the cycle of life, or the circle of life from Lion King. It did not go well. But then it hit me. That's exactly what happens in the world in which we live and we move and we have our being. We're seeking something of progress and meaning, and it seems to just evaporate like our warm breath on a cool morning. And what do we got left? Let's go to Ecclesiastes. Why don't we turn there? If there was ever an introduction into the world in which we live that deals with truth, it's this book. I think this book is a starting place for anyone who doesn't know about God in the world in which we're living. We used to go to Genesis in a different era. We would have gone to Genesis because we would start with the Creator and how we got here. The three major philosophical questions anyone ever has to answer is, number one, my existence. You got two options in the marketplace. Each of us has to wrestle with that question. How did I get here? That's the first. And second, based on the first answer, the second question anyone has to ask is, what is my value? What purpose do I serve? And depending on your view of who you are, your value either has an elevated sense, if I'm created, then I'm in the image of God. But if I've evolved, which is the only other option, then I am just part of the animal kingdom that just has the ability to reason and speak a particular communicative language, and we want to create things, and we have opposable thumbs. That's kind of it. You're left with biology. But then there's a third question that we have to deal with, and that's evil. Why do we call anything evil? Presupposes that we believe there's something that is a standard for which we aspire, that something is against it. In other words, there's bad in the world. Why do we even say there's bad in the world? We presuppose there's something about the rightness and wrongness of things. So we have a moral compass that tells us there's a moral guide. There's a North Star telling us something is right and wrong in the world. Otherwise, we have no reason to complain against anything wrong in the world. So we have to deal with the issue of evil, number three, that it exists. And why do we feel the way we do about it? The fourth is, what's our solution to the problem of evil? What you're seeing happening right now across our country is we don't have a unified system of approaching what do we do about evil. Everybody's got their own personal evils, or maybe the evils in another person. But the circumstance is, it's chaotic. It's chaotic out there if we don't understand these simplistic, although not simple, they're not simpletons, but how to determine our existence, our value, evil, and its solution. That's where we need to wrestle with these things individually, but we also have this general complaint against the universe of which we can't control. I'm upset for a reason. The word I used earlier was angst. I don't like the fact that a 17-year-old slug bug gets wings and dies in his first flight. Maybe I should have named that thing Titanic or something like that. The first time you go, you fail. When I came to Ecclesiastes as a new believer, not having read my Bible much at all until, as you know from my earlier conversations concerning Drake and his mentorship and discipling me in the study of the Word of God, I didn't know what to do with these books. And I read Ecclesiastes as a college student, and I suddenly went, this book is so real. It's telling the truth on the world in which I was seeing life unfold. I get to my college class in philosophy at SMU, and my professor was describing this book as being so pessimistic, they had to hand it to a second writer to make things nice because it was so negative about the world in which the Jews lived. And I'm thinking, no, it's the most optimistic book I've ever read because it tells the truth about how bad things are. But it doesn't end there. That would be nihilism or nihilism. We could thank a number of philosophers for those words. In other words, what do you do with the world that's broken? Ecclesiastes tells the truth, number one, that it is broken. But it also addresses a question that we often don't deal with ourselves. We have our own ambitions. We believe something to be true that prompts us to do something with our life toward that end that brings all of our resources, our faculties, our energies to accomplish that. You get up every morning to do something because you believe you are part of a larger story being told around the value in the universe that seems meaningless. How's that for absurdity? But you do it. So when you open up the book of Ecclesiastes, and we're going to cover the entire book superficially, of course, I want to hit just a couple of high points, and then we're going to keep going. But with regard to Ecclesiastes, how would you like to read, starting in chapter 1, verse 1? Do not worry, we're not going to cover every single verse. I'm not going to read the thing. We have the Lord's Supper to look forward to. We'll get there. I believe that Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, was written by Solomon for the reasons that appear to be textually obvious. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, meaningless is the word. Says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. How's that for an opening line to your book? It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. The tale of? Two cities. What are the two cities? London and Paris. They were in conflict with each other. The bourgeois of London and the proletariat growing out of Paris. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Considered to be one of the all-time great openers in a book. I would say this is one of the great openers next to John chapter 1. Right out of the gate, we learn that it's all meaningless. But why? We just sang, it is my Father's world. And in that, hymn, as Drake pointed out, this is the perspective of recognizing in the midst of the chaos, the evil, the uncertainty, God is at work doing amazing things. And if we notice what he's doing, we'll hear the music of the spheres and all around us rings the sounds of God's grace. The music of the spheres itself is a phrase borrowed from Cicero, the great Roman orator, in a book that he wrote concerning the dream of Scipio. And in the middle of his dream, Scipio heard the music of the spheres, and they realized something's going on in the world. And we rightly took that back from where it had been borrowed, that God has created the world with meaning, order, and purpose, but sin has ravaged it into the things that he created for good. We are now making it a lesser world. So how does this look in our life? Ecclesiastes, I'm going to jump on just a couple of these and then we'll move ahead. Three. What advantage does man have in all the work which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Babies are born, people die, but the world keeps going. I think we've seen this happen in funerals that we attend when an elderly saint goes home to be with the Lord and we commemorate and celebrate their life. And somewhere in the course of the preacher's eulogy, you will hear a baby cry. And we're reminded that in the passing of one generation, there's the beginning of the next. And the grace of God continues in the life of the families that are there. That's what he's saying in this opening line. The world goes on, and we come and go. I'm going to slip down a little further. So, verse 11. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also of the later things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. I love history. I love reading old dead guys. I love my grandparents who are with Jesus. I love their memory. I love my mother and my father. My father died last May, approaching the one-year anniversary of that passing. There are those people in our life, though, that aren't our family, that have also impacted us. The great football player Herb Adderley played for the Green Bay Packers in the 60s and the Cowboys in the 70s when he ended his career. And someone asked him, he said, how has Vince Lombardi impacted your life? And Herb Adderley responded, he said, you know, I love my father. I know he loved me. But I don't think of my father every day, but I think of Vince Lombardi every day. Who are the people in our life that impacted us? And even though they're gone, they're still with us. And then suddenly our memory goes away. Does the memory of them go away? Unless it's written down somewhere, it does. So there's that heaviness of, okay, what does our life look like? I think we spend the first half of our life trying to get old and the second half of our life trying to get young. You know, we kind of reverse the order. Well, gravity used to hold us down, and now we just blame gravity for what brings us down. The body feels the weight of gravity, doesn't it? Well, there's an element around which he says in verse 12, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I've set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. Pretty exhaustive idea here. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I've seen all the works that have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. You get nothing for it. So his first pursuit is wisdom. By the way, for all of you who have ever thought about going to college, you can appreciate he was aspiring to go to the next level of education. Then he moves down into verse 1 of chapter 2. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure, so enjoy yourself. Hedonistic, Epicurean. And behold, it was too futile. I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I mean, that was fun, but I'm kind of bored with this game. You know what I mean? So anyway, imagine, if you will, the guy is headed off to college and he's going to pursue wisdom. That's why he wants to go. His GPA matters. His SAT matters. The school he's going to go to, his major is going to matter. And when does he get to college? What does he look for? He's thinking about education, but the first 48 hours of your college experience will set essentially most of the course of your college life. You know why? The first time you engage anybody on college campus, living on campus, typically a party. Who you associate with? My wife and I took our daughter to Baylor. We stepped onto the campus. We did all the, you know, the family things you do. Your kids are there. You're there. I'm trying to do this kind of cultic thing they do with this bear thing. You know, put your hand over your knee and raise it up. I said, no, I'm from SMU. I ain't doing no bear claw thing. But you can see it's an indoctrination into Baylor. I get it. It's really cool. But there's a certain moment that happens where after they had an ice cream social, they take you to a particular part of the campus and there's a road. And there's a causeway and a nice little area here. And the moment you get to that road, you're supposed to say goodbye. And your child crosses the road into their college career. And you know what they're saying, parents? See ya. And for a lot of those kids, it's crazy time. So you go there for an education, but your first introduction to college life is pleasure. That's what he did. Second. Third, what do you do when you get to end of school? Hey, I better take this serious and get me a good degree, get me a good job, get me an internship. And you know what you're looking for third? Money. Need to get a job. You see that in chapter 2, verse 12. So I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly, for what will the man do who will come after the king except what he has been done already? I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, and yet I know that one fate befalls them all, or both. When I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I know, or I said to myself, this too is vanity. He goes on and on and on, and this is vanity, 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 vanity. It's like, what's the point? This is such a repetitive world that does not satisfy. The old line from a song back in the 80s, you can look at the menu, but you cannot eat. You can get to the point of being attracted to something for which you have no engagement. And you become a spectator of what appears to be meaningful, but when you deal with it, it just seems unquenched. And then you look up and you go, this isn't working. So I said earlier about the negativity that's all of a sudden got this kind of light of this meaningful, good stuff. Jump ahead with me to chapter 2, verse 26. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen. It is from the hand of God. God has shown up before about having given tasks for men to do, but now Solomon, in his wisdom, is reaching an initial conclusion that, wait, this apparent vanity actually has an answer. There is a dilemma of value that is answered by an activity from God. He gives us something. Notice what he gives us. His labor is good. I have seen that it is from the hand of God, for who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? God provides good gifts to his children who are living in an apparently meaningless world. In the face of the order that we had been given, we sinned and we lost it. And it became chaos, Sin ruins what God had created. And all the things he gave us to do now feel futile because it's against something called the entropy, or the loss of energy or chaos that emerges from our efforts. And we lose something. Except there's a turning point. God has given to us in our apparent meaninglessness of the world something as simple as a meal and enjoyment of life. It's often been said that when someone is struggling or struggling and dealing with depression, one of the first things people will ask them is, are you eating? It's a simple thing. David even said it in Psalm 23. He has prepared a table in the midst or in the presence of my enemies. You don't eat with enemies. There's too much anxiety. You could kill each other. You know what the assumption is in the song, at least on my take, is that God has made peace between enemies and they eat together. To sit at a table and to eat is a gift from God. That seems so irrelevant. How did God minister to Elijah after he felt that he was all alone, the only one left? All the other prophets have left you. What did God do with Elijah? He fed him. The angels fed him. So this idea that somehow this meal, as simple as it is actually a benefit of the grace of God. So he then goes on to say, verse 26, for to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he has given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after wind, not for the person who receives, but for the person who's laboring without purpose or any relationship with God. For those of you who are interested in the song from the 60s, There Is a Time, you remember those, I won't sing it because it'll be in your head, my bad singing, not the lyrics of the song, but the idea of the birds did this, B-Y-R-D, and the idea is they took it straight out of Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and their thesis was, it's time for the war to end, it's time for peace. We've had the time for war, okay, we're done, let's move on to the time for peace. And that was the whole thesis of the song. But it was taken straight out of this idea of time in chapter 3. But there's another footnote, the second blessing, if I can tell you the first was chapter 2, verses 24 through 26. The second blessing that comes, this sense of redemptive grace, the order in the chaos, is, I'm going to read just a portion of it, verse 7. A time to tear apart and a time to sew together, a time to be silent, a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. Okay, time, the cycle of time. And then you get to the next verse in chapter 3, verse 9. What profit is there to the worker from which he is, in which he toils? I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in his time. God created time, but time is not the only element in which we live. There's another element that we sense exists beyond the world in which we live, that marks our when we punch the clock to get in and when we punch the clock to get out. In other words, most of our day is defined by the punching of a clock and some economic value attached to our efforts, a per hour rate. Here, though, he tells us something else. Verse 11, he made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart. Now, this one is a bolt from the blue. You don't see this one coming. The Gospel of John deals with eternity all the time. Eternity was a well-known concept to the Jews in their literature. It comes from more than just this passage, but let me borrow this passage. He has set eternity in their heart. We have an appreciation without a full understanding of something called a timelessness. We have an appreciation and we have an understanding of some version of eternity for which there's neither beginning nor ending. We would call it infinity in some math concept or some physics. But the idea is this.
The idea of eternity is tied also to 1 Corinthians chapter 13 of the three Christian virtues. Two of them expire when the perfect comes. Faith, hope, and love are the three Christian virtues. I think Ecclesiastes deals with faith. This is a world of chaos where things seem meaningless, but all of a sudden, if you believe and understand what God is doing, you'll see the world totally different. That's faith. But faith goes away because what do you have? You have sight. The second Christian virtue is hope. Hope is the anticipation with the certainty that something that you anticipate will come true. But if time has expired and you're living in the eternity, then hope also goes away. You don't need it. You're experiencing it. I hope we got to the church on time. Having driven through the storm, the floods, it rained a lot in Terrell last night. There's a lot of water in the ditches. But our hope was no longer necessary when we pulled up on time and Drake wasn't nervous. Or David wasn't nervous. The third Christian virtue is love. And what does Paul say about love? It is the greatest. Why is it the greatest? It doesn't expire. Love does not expire. And you know why it doesn't expire? It's eternal. It transcends time. And can I offer a particular perspective about how we know that there is an eternity? Is when we love in any of its versions. I can point out a couple of examples. If we love and we're in the experience of either loving someone or being loved by someone, there's some mutual understanding of that, and time stands still, and you look up and you go, where did the time go? Let me tell you how it happened to you, fellas. Remember back in the day, you were late with your girlfriend, and your daddy said, why are you late? Oh, the time got away from me. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have clocks. We just had to kind of look up and do the sun's thing. And, you know, it's like, or maybe it was late at night. I didn't have any idea what time it was. We didn't have wristwatches. Or, you know, we made excuses for, we were in love and time went away. You remember those days? The moment you are oblivious to time, there's eternity set in your mind. So love makes time go away. That's what I'm thinking. I think that's what Paul was telling us. I think that's what Ecclesiastes is teaching us. That we know there's something beyond the veil of the events, sequenced out in a chronology of our life, that there is something behind the time that tells us there's value in the human soul that will experience a reality of our existence for all time, because time is gone. By the way, the contrast to that is how long it takes something to happen if you're bored. You ever notice that? Man, he is going on and on. This is taking forever. See, I can be in love on one side and the other person's bored and they're like looking at their watch and I'm going, what time is it? Who cares what time it is? Y'all know where I'm coming from, right? You know what you've had this happen to you. This is a real test of the commonality of the human experience. Because I can say this stuff and y'all get it. You know immediately when you're bored. You don't have enough challenges in your life and you're sitting around with, you know, your teeth in your mouth and twiddling your thumbs because you want to do something meaningful. And the moment you get involved in doing something like that, you don't even think about the time because you love what you're doing. All right, I'll rest my case on that one. I think that's principle number two. Let's go to another one. Let's go to chapter 3, verse, the last one, 22. I'm going to ask y'all just to note that there's a few of these, and we will have been done with Ecclesiastes, but I'm about to change gears on you because I'm going to turn the page, not the age. I have seen that nothing is better than man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot, for who will bring him to see what will occur after him? Solomon seems to be talking about these good things, almost pleasurable things, with great frequency, and he's telling the truth, but we tend to read this a bit differently. We talk about having fun as if being happy is having fun. I will offer that in every one of these stories, the same is true. There is a strenuous effort that can produce a meaninglessness,
But there's also, in the Christian perspective coming straight out of Ecclesiastes and in the New Testament, there is a strenuous effort that produces an exceedingly valuable result. And we, rather than being happy, although that's the word that's used, I want to elevate this. I want to talk about the word joy. Joy is the blessed experience of having seen that your effort matters and it brings dignity to you as an image bearer of God, that you're doing something that's meaningful, even if the effort you're doing doesn't seem to be meaningful. In other words, the effort you're bringing to the task is more important than the task you're achieving. I woke up one morning in my high school days. My father was good about ripping the covers off us and yelling, "Get up and be somebody." That's what every high school kid wants to hear in their summer vacation days. But it stuck in my mind that the morning was full of possibility. I remember one morning, though, it didn't feel like that. I woke up in the yard where we had our corn. I grew up on 35 acres. We had about 3 or 4 acres that we farmed. The rest of it was we farmed out. We leased out the property to farmers. I grew up around okra, cantaloupe, onions. Hated them all. Wouldn't eat any of them. I was surrounded by it. But one morning I woke up and there was rows of corn. I've got a hoe in my hand. I'm dressed, but I woke up hoeing corn. I still do not understand how in the world I ended up having been asleep and ending up in the field hoeing corn. I realized my father had awakened us with his wake up and be somebody, and he told me to go hoe the corn, and I did it in my sleep. And I came to my senses. Where am I? What am I doing? And there's any number of you who've done the exact same thing without the story of a boy and his dad in the summer, and it wasn't about the corn you were hoeing. As you wake up one day and you go, what am I doing? How did I get here? And all of a sudden the challenge is the work that I'm doing meaningful? And I would argue there's a good chance that it really is kind of temporal. Had a friend of mine, he worked for Reynolds Tobacco. He's a strong believer. He did not believe in smoking and did not think it was a good idea that people should smoke. But for 18 years, he served as the CFO of a particular brand under Reynolds. And finally, he said, I'm really good at my job. It's blessed my family. We are so taken back by how good God has been to us. And then it hit him. Wait a minute. I don't want to make people smoke better. I want to do something else with my life. Well, the content was what the job he was doing, but the way in which he did it, the task that God had given him, was a blessing to him. You see the difference here? I think at some point we feel that strain and that struggle. I know a lot of people who are not in ministry that are strong believers feel that somehow their work is diminished if it's not directly attached to a ministry. Do I have a value as an employee if I'm not doing God's work in a ministry? And the answer is, yes, you do. I know Drake is, we've all dealt with this in the ministry, is people will look at you. Drake's been the pastor, how many years now, Drake, at this church? 38 years. You know the average tenure? Three. I graduated with a group of guys, one of whom was the pastor of a church for 35 years. I did not go directly into church ministry. I went into education within the Christian school community. Then I worked into other organizations that I was helping along my career. People will look at me and say, well, when did you leave the ministry? I understand the question because people's frame of reference is ministry isn't a church or some parachurch organization. But what about the men and women who are not part of a Christian ministry? Is their work in vain? Not at all. It might be, but that's no guarantee. Are we okay with this? Can I say this? So what is the task you've been given? It's a blessing from God if you understand how to see the work you're doing, that it comes from Him. All right. We're going to jump to the end of the book. I know you're waiting for this. So he goes on. There's a lot of this. We could spend a lot of time in the book of Ecclesiastes. I encourage you to do that. I'll tell you this. If you're getting started on your life and you're trying to figure out where you are in the world, Ecclesiastes will ground you about the world you're getting into If you're in the middle of it and you're struggling, it's an encouragement to you. Yes, in the difficulty of all the stuff you're dealing with, God has a purpose that he is still blessing you. Look around and thank him for it. You with me on this one? Because ultimately, we're in a world of decline. There is an entropy of energy going out of the system. Things are winding down. Things break. But there's this grace that rises up in the midst of that, and he blesses us as his people. He takes care of us. That's a statement of faith. In a fallen world, there is still the rise of grace to redeem the times. So you get to the end of the book, and he reaches the conclusion, which in my read is the seventh of these type of, oh yeah, but. If you'll look with me, chapter 12, verse 9. In addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, and he pondered, searched out, and arranged many proverbs. We see the book of Proverbs at least covering that. This book is full of proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words and to write words with truth correctly. The words of wise men are like goads, and masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd. But beyond this, my son, be warned, the writing of many books is endless. He hadn't even seen what we've done with the books. Hello, Amazon. I don't know about you. You ever been to Half Price Books? I love Half Price Books. I love to go to the manger one in Dallas on Northwest Highway. It used to be in Captain Cargo, the old leftovers of a restaurant. Many layers. It was an interesting ship. Anyway, every time I go in there, I'm excited to find a deal. And then I feel sorry for the author that put all of his heart and soul in that book. And I'm griping to find it on the clearance section. So I'm like, oh man, you want your books to have value, not somebody to give them away. And I'm buying them on the cheap. Nevertheless, there were many books. An excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. They had parchments. They don't have what we have. I have more books at my disposal in this device than the history of libraries. Isn't that crazy to think about? And I'm never satisfied. Well, here's the conclusion. I always like it when the writer tells us that. The conclusion when all has been heard is fear God and keep his commandments. Two things. Sound familiar? What is the greatest commandment? Love the Lord and your neighbor as yourself. Wonder where all of the law is gathered up. All of the world perspective is gathered up. All the apparent meaninglessness and all the cycles of life and all the other things is wrapped up in two essential verbs. Fear God. Why would you fear God? Proverbs says, what is the fear of God? The beginning of wisdom. And the beginning of wisdom says this: we know the difference between what is true and what is false. We have a perspective on the world that's different than just living in it. If I could say it this way, the wise man knows there's a fool. The fool doesn't even know he's a fool. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. The fear of God, not only knowing he exists, but a proper relationship to him, is the beginning of wisdom. How do you see the world? If you want to, you can see the negative in the world. You can see the chaos in the world and call it what it is. But if that's where you end, it's a dark road you've begun. Albert Camus, in his great work from 1955, The Myth of Sisyphus, which for him, actually it was 1940 and he wrote it later, but all of his books came from this one idea that you have to manage your suicide day to day. You've got to be kidding me. I think I told y'all last fall when I was here that I was involved in a project trying to bring help to those who are struggling with suicidal ideation and the idea of the mental health crisis that many of our children and adults are facing. In the world, every 40 seconds, someone takes their life. Every 40 seconds. We ran a public service video the 57 NFL quarterbacks who were trying to say, stay here, don't take your life, you matter, stay in our huddle, we need you. Those 57 quarterbacks created a video that by intention was 40 seconds long. That's the average time between the end of a play in the NFL and the start of a new play. It's called the 40-second clock. And it was a reminder to us that every 40 seconds, we need to extend the time. We need to make it longer, that fewer people will take their life. The result of that, in 14 days, over 200 million people saw that video. And we have testimonies of people that tried again. We'll go another day. They delayed their suicide. That didn't mean they took their life. It just means think of the concept that people are living without any hope in the world. The chaos is all around us. The decline is all around us. That's the universal experience of living in a fallen world. But if you understand that God is going to redeem us because he created us and he's going to bring us to himself, we have purpose. And we can see hopeful. We can reach out in meaning and purpose and know that our ambition is not in vain. We can aspire as we see eternity is set in our heart and we desire those things that are eternal. We're attracted to those eternal things. And when we are headed in that direction, acknowledging, fearing the Lord changes everything. And then the second thing, keep his commandments. Why? Because to disobey him is to do what Adam and Eve did when they followed the voice of Satan. It's death. So commandments are given as stones to life. We step on them. They're certain. So the appeal here at the end of the book, because this applies to every person, for God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil, and the book closes. And a hopeful note, a truthful note. Well, I'm right near at the end, really close. I had two other passages, but I'm going to stop. I'm going to pause. Because I want to summarize in another way. We're looking at a book. In a world in which we live, this book is reflective of the world in which we live. How do you see the world, though, determines everything. My grandparents, I love my grandparents. I learned so much from them. I remember driving my old car one day with my grandmother, and I'm driving along, and I can hear something clicking that didn't seem to be good. And my grandmother is sitting next to me, loved taking her with me, and I'm driving down the road. I hear the clicking, and I say, called her Mama. Her name is Virgie. I said, Mama, my car seems to be making some noises I don't like. She goes, well, just don't listen. I remember thinking, I can't, you know, that sounds good, but I think maybe something will break and maybe I should listen. I guess you could consider me the pessimist at that particular point. She's the optimist. Which is going to be best for my car was the question. Whether was I going to keep driving or was I going to end up walking? I think there's that moment when you've seen a lot of pain in your world, you have to kind of look past it. And there are a lot of things that will scare you that go bump in the night. And my grandmother was saying, go beyond these little things that make you nervous. She was not saying be negligent. She was teaching me something. See past the things that scare you. Because there's meaning in the world. There's hope in your desperation. You up for that? The world in which we live is known as a dissipative structure. The idea is this. It's a self-organizing structure that takes the waste of another system. And every single day, this system works. Our sun, 93 million miles away, every day turns around and is spewing cosmic matter. Coronal mass ejection is what it's called, and like a sprinkler revolving around every 27 to 28 days, the sun is turning on its axis, spewing the CMEs all over the universe, and sometimes it collides with our planet. It goes into the poles, electromagnetic energy. It does an aerosol thing on our upper atmosphere. It affects all of our clouds. It affects all of our thunderstorms. The thing that happened last night is affected by it. But you know what really happens every day? The sun shines. It impacts our atmosphere. And in our world of carbon dioxide and water, sun uses a plant to do what? The sunlight in that plant is called photosynthesis. And it has this miraculous thing that happens. It draws the carbon dioxide, which would kill us if we don't exhale it.
It takes the carbon dioxide and it combines it with an atom from hydrogen from the water, and it creates carbohydrates, which is the plantous fiber and the life in which we eat. Hello, plants. See, I'm a vegetarian through a cow. I let my cow eat my veggies, and then I eat that cow. All right? So I'm a vegetarian through a cow. But through the plant life, because it comes from the sun, is coming into our world, and now not only do we get carbohydrates, we get oxygen, because it kicks off an atom of oxygen. And here we go. I get to eat and breathe and live from the waste of the sun. So the world that we live in is a structure that is taking the waste of another world and turning it into life. I don't know. Maybe that chaos from the sun, which is what it is. Maybe that waste, that's that plasma stuff coming our way. Maybe that's really reflective of our world. Maybe our world is in chaos. Maybe your life is in chaos. Maybe you feel the frustration and the futility. And you need energy from somewhere else to come into your life and shape your life from chaos to order. And to provide something that used to be poison to my breath is now life because I can breathe it. Or the things that I need, as the writer Solomon has said in Ecclesiastes, he gives us a meal to eat. And we're happy. You know how this happens? You believe. And God's grace is the energy that comes from outside our world of chaos and destruction and death and sin. And it comes into us and provides life if we believe. Everything right in Genesis 2 was ruined by Genesis 3, except for one verse in Genesis 3:15. He will crush the head. Right out of the gate, in the midst of that sin, we recognize God is promising Jesus will come and he will destroy the work of the serpent. And he will turn life around for us. But it's only him that does that. We don't need to go back from Genesis chapter 3 to Genesis chapter 2 and reclaim the garden. That angel said, "You ain't coming back." And he guarded us from ever going back in to eat the tree of life. Our way is forward. And our way forward was to an incarnation. Our way forward was to a crucifixion. And our way forward was a resurrection of Jesus Christ. And our way forward, in the midst of our chaos and our ruination and all of our meaninglessness, is to know that God has sent his Son to redeem us from the fall. And everything changes when we say, "I believe." And everything changes because the grace that he gives to us, we could never do ourselves. And we symbolize that and we memorialize that. As a church, we will enjoy communion. Let me pray for us. Father in heaven, I thank you for this amazing story that comes to us from the book of Ecclesiastes, that there is chaos in this world, and yet there is grace, there is beautiful things you've given to us, and there is nothing meaningless in your world. We do rejoice that it is your world. Father, we thank you for Jesus Christ, your Son. We thank you for the work that he's done to demonstrate that he is the revelation of the Father, and we've heard his voice and we trust in him. And in his name we pray.